Well, good afternoon, members. Welcome to the House of Representatives Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee. Our first item of business is to take the roll. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Hornstein present. Vice Chair Cagle. Cagle present.
Present. Thanks.
Representative Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Representative Barr.
Here.
Barr present. Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi present. Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Elkins present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Frederick present. Representative Hausman.
Present.
Hausman present. Representative Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick present. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Nelson present. Representative Olson.
Olson present.
Olson present. Representative Richardson.
Present.
Richardson present. Representative Torkelson.
Torkelson present.
Torkelson present. Representative West.
Present.
West present. There is a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge. Our next item of business is approval of the minutes from our March 8th meeting. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move the minutes of the March 8th meeting.
Thank you. Minutes have been moved. Is there a discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the approval of the March 8th minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Thank you, members. Today we have three bills on the agenda and also an informational presentation from MnDOT about our the current state of our trunk highway bonding program, which has a lot of bearing on the work that we're doing this session, as there are a number of trunk highway bonding bills. And of course, that is one of the sources of the Corridors of Commerce program, which we discussed last week. So very important and timely information. I will be handing over the virtual gavel at some point, probably midway through this hearing, to Vice Chair Cagle, as I have a bill in another committee. So our first bill on the agenda is House File 3600, Representative Long's bill, and I will move that House File 3600 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus transportation bill. Members, this is under our jurisdiction as it relates to pipelines and pipeline safety, so that's why this bill is in our committee. Representative Long, welcome to the Transportation Committee. I believe this is your first bill in our committee, so we welcome you and appreciate your presence with us today. Please tell us about House File 3600.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is an honor to be here with you in the Transportation Committee. So House File 3600 is pretty straightforward. It seeks to provide better information to the Department of Public Safety's Office of Pipeline Safety on two particular topics. First, reporting of on-time performance in response to utilities locate requests for when they're digging or other needs to locate utilities. And second, to report utility damages. In 2020, there were over 2,000 damages reported, but these were a mixture of voluntary and mandatory reporting. And so this bill would be moving us from the current framework to one that is mandatory, so we are collecting better and more accurate information. It does exempt small utilities, those that have under 5,000 notifications received in a year, from the requirement. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask have the testifiers explain more detail about the bill.
Thank you, Representative Long. And we have, I think, first, would you like Mr. Wolfgram?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Mr. Wolfgram, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Hornstein and committee members. My name is John Wolfgram. I'm the Chief Engineer with the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. I'll be providing you with an overview of House File 3600. I'd like to start by thanking Representative Long for introducing this bill today. Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety has regulatory oversight over the state's call before you dig laws in Minnesota Statute 216D. These laws are aimed to keep people safe while digging around underground utilities, as well as protecting those utilities from being damaged. This includes gas pipelines, liquid pipelines, as well as sewer, water, electric, and telecom facilities. These statutes provide a framework where a homeowner or a contractor can request that underground utilities be marked before digging occurs. These notifications are facilitated by Gopher State OneCall. Over 900,000 notifications were facilitated by GSOC in 2020 and in 2021. House File 3600 aims to add metric reporting requirements for utility companies. These reports would be facilitated electronically by the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety to collect the number of utility locate requests by type, the percentage of requests marked on time, as well as reporting of any damages to a given utility. MNOPS currently utilizes a framework of mandatory reporting for pipeline companies, as well as voluntary reporting for telecom, electric, sewer, and water companies to track damages. The past number of years, we typically have one damage per every 1,000 requests. In the last couple of years, we've typically had around 1,500 excavation damages to Minnesota distribution gas pipelines. House File 3600 aims to add in additional data for the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety to better monitor the effectiveness of our state's One Call Law, keeping people safe, protecting underground facilities, as well as keeping excavation contractors productive. Be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wolfgram. Are there any questions of the testifier? I don't see any, so thank you for your testimony. Of course, questions could pop up at any time, so please stay with us here. And we also have Ms. Pisick from the Associated General Contractors. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and committee members. It's good to see you all. My name is Sarah Pisick, and I'm representing the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota, or AGC of Minnesota, a nonprofit construction industry trade association dedicated to promoting opportunity and excellence in the building and highway construction industries throughout Minnesota. Our 400 plus members include general contractors, specialty contractors, and affiliated businesses who have a vested interest in these industries. AGC of Minnesota appreciates the opportunity to engage and advocate for House File 3600, and we thank Representative Long for sponsoring the bill. One of AGC's goals is to prioritize worker safety, the general public, and utility infrastructure. A recent national survey conducted by the Associated General Contractors of America found significant flaws in the current 811 utility location system. Nationally, most contractors said that calling 811 often leads to inaccurate line marking and that utility firms are often very slow in coming out to locate and mark underground lines. Our contractors in Minnesota report similar frustrations. House File 3600 is a good first step in addressing this problem. The bill requires reporting and collection of data regarding the current excavation notice system. We look forward to working with the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety to analyze the data that is collected and find ways to reduce flaws in the current system. AGC of Minnesota is committed to the goal of ensuring worker safety, underground damage prevention, and the safety of the public. Thank you for your consideration of this bill and look forward to working with you on future initiatives.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members will have one last opportunity if anyone has questions for either testifier at this time. I don't see any hands. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Representative Petersburg has his hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Petersburg. I didn't see that. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Is this last testifiers, or are we going to have some more?
These are the only testifiers on my list. Do you have anyone else, Representative Long, Chairman Long?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Petersburg.
Okay, so thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Long. And I know I've been working, well, actually, when I first started here back in 2013, working with agricultural excavators, tilers, and so forth, in dealing with something called farm taps. And so those of you that may not know this, when natural gas lines came close to homes out in the country, they were allowed to tap into the natural gas to have natural gas into their building sites. Now, the way the law was at that time was from that farm tap, which was right at the pipeline, to the building site was considered an independent utility owned by the person who was getting, who was using the gas or the building site. Unfortunately, when Gopher One was called, et cetera, that information was not available for them to even notify whether or not there was a tap there or not. So there were a lot of concerns about who would get notified. We're getting Tyler's saying that they didn't know this gas line was here. They plowed through it. All of a sudden, gas would be shooting up out of the ground. And it's very concerning. And so we worked with the pipelines to get better notification of that. My question in this regard to this bill, how would those be impacted by what you're doing with this notification? At one time, there were 1,900 of these in the state of Minnesota. If you have some insight, I'd appreciate that.
Is that a question to the author, or maybe Mr. Wolfgram may have some?
Defer to Mr. Wolfgram. I think he'll have more expertise than I.
Yeah, Mr. Wolfgram.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, this would basically involve the pipeline companies themselves as far as the reporting requirements. So the interstate companies that, you know, would basically own those farm taps, or the LDCs that are basically kind of contract operating them. So it would involve all the pipeline infrastructure that we would have as far as the reporting would be concerned. I can certainly look in to clarify as to who currently has the responsibility for those farm taps and be happy to provide that information back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Wolfgram. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Petersburg?
Yeah, I think that would be helpful because that's the challenge, is that the farm tap from that to the building site is owned by the building site owner himself. And most of the companies don't know the address of that person or anything. And so it's been very difficult to get a handle on that, and even the owners, because of transferring a property, may not even know where it is themselves to even know where to start. So that is an issue that has been working, and I think Merck has been trying to deal with some of that as well. And I think the PUC has been reluctant to give them the authority to actually take ownership of all these pipelines, or I should say farm taps, up to the building site. So if anything that you could do to help in that regard, I think it would be helpful, because those are still some dangerous situations for excavators. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for the question and the comment, Representative Petersburg. Okay, I'm going to see one last time if we have some hands up.
Oh, try.
I don't see any. Oh, is there someone? I hear some voice.
I am trying.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Let's see your hand now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I view any damage to the pipelines as being extremely dangerous, because I have seen some major fires. So my question is, the numbers that I'm seeing or that you had put forward sounds like a lot of damages or invasions. So if you could just tell me, am I correct in that assumption, or what would be a typical year just for the numbers? I guess to me, anything above one.
Number of pipeline mishaps are a major one. I think that would also be a question, Representative Long, for Mr. Wolfgram.
Yes.
Mr. Wolfgram.
Chair Hornstein, Representative Mason, since our One Call Law has kind of been enacted back in, you know, the late 80s, you know, we started out, you know, around, you know, very high damages per thousand rate. We've gone from 10 to 9 to 8, and I'd be happy to send some of those facts to the committee as well. For the last number of years, we typically hover, you know, just over one damage per thousand on all of our locates. When we're looking at damages each year. So specifically to the pipelines, I stated that we're seeing excavation damages in the tune of, you know, around 1,500 damages a year. That might be a case where the pipeline, you know, maybe was nicked or a tracer wire was cut or we had a complete sever. But typically we're seeing, you know, in excess of one damage, one and a half damages per every 1,000 locate each year. So I think we've got to a point where our metrics and our processes have kind of plateaued, where we really need to get additional data to kind of further figure out how do we, you know, get below one? How do we drive that amount of damages down to zero? You know, so to protect people, protect those that infrastructure that's there.
Thank you, okay. Mr. Wolfram. Any follow-upers on this?
Thank you. No, as long as he's trying to get the numbers down, I'm happy.
Okay. Thank you for that. All right, members, I see no further questions. And so any closing comments, Representative and Chairman Long?
I appreciate the committee hearing the bill. I think it's important and common sense. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thanks for the bill, Chairman Long. And with that, we will lay over House File 3600 for possible inclusion in an omnibus transportation bill. Thank you, Chairman Long. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 3635. We got all these even numbers, 3600, 3635 today. Representative Dabney, and welcome back to the committee, Mr. Chair. And you've had a long and great history of bringing us some very good bills to this committee. And this is another one. I appreciate that. Well, you had one last year. Of course, blocking the box was, I think, one that I'll always appreciate. But welcome back to the committee. And I am going to move that House File 3635 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Dabney, please tell us about the bill.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you for those kind words. I like to think that while I'm not here often, I prioritize quality over quantity when
Excellent.
It comes to the Transportation Committee.
That is a very good reminder to all of us, I think.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, last weekend's snow and rain, the wintry mix that illustrates well the Minnesota conditions that create the need for House File 3635. Those conditions can make getting on and off of transit vehicles more challenging, especially for riders with mobility challenges. Challenging driving conditions for the operators can obstruct easy access to bus stops, making for hazardous experiences getting on and off the bus. House File 3635 hopes to protect rider safety through increased operator training. I believe with us today is my constituent, Joy Rindle Hayden. Ms. Rindle Hayden was injured after disembarking from a Metro Transit bus on a snowy and icy day. And her experience illustrates the value of this training for transit operators in assisting passengers with disabilities. There may be some other people on your list, Mr. Chair, also prepared to testify in favor of the bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Dabney. And let's go now directly to our citizen testimony. And Ms. Rindles Hayden, welcome to the Transportation Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, I am Joy Rindles Hayden, and I live in Representative Dabney's district in South Minneapolis, 63A. Thank you for your opportunity to testify today in support of the House File 3635. My accident happened about 3:40 p.m. coming home from therapy on Monday, January 9th, 2017. My bus stopped at the 38th in Chicago and getting off to transfer to the 23 from the 5. Because of the timing of the buses, I didn't have a lot of time to make the transfer. The bus stop is near what was a convenience store. The parking lot and gas pumps were cleared of snow, but the snow was piled on the sidewalk. I use a walker. The bus driver used a hydraulic ramp so I could get off the bus, but the ground was covered with snow. The sidewalk wasn't cleared properly, and the ramp wasn't on the sidewalk. In fact, it was still folded up in the curb. I stepped out, lifting my walker's front wheels sideways. The back wheels caught behind me. I pulled and pulled, and suddenly the wheels came over the top, and I fell backwards and landed on Chicago Avenue. Eventually, this injury caused me to lose consciousness. I sustained a brain bleed, and had an ischemic stroke. The stroke affected my speech. I was very fortunate my speech and my cognitive abilities came back. I spent 17 days in the hospital and had to undergo rehab. They wanted me to stay another week, but I really didn't have the money for that. Walker users such as me could face similar situations moving forward because of the angles of the ramps. Remember, walkers are all based on the side on 45-degree angles, hydraulic ramps, 90-degree angles. These are incompatible. I saw a sign at the 38th Street Station near where I live and called an accident prevention poster there. The people at Metro Transit understood the cause of the accident, and as a retired teacher, I tried to work with them for 4 years to develop curriculum to train the drivers. This is a preventable accident, and education is the key. The incident didn't happen. I've partnered since then with the Brain Injury Alliance because I wasn't getting anywhere by myself, to include training for the bus drivers to increase passenger safety, particularly in bad weather. And this is what the bill does, and I hope you'll support House File 3635. The accident has had a deep impact on my life, personally, emotionally, and financially. And I'm here because the accident is preventable. At our meeting last August with Metro Transit, we discussed three solutions that would have prevented the accident at this location. I want to do everything I can to keep it from happening again.
Thank you so much, Ms. Rindles-Hayden. Thank you for sharing your story with us as well. Very much appreciated, and I think you articulate the need for this kind of training. Our next testifier is Cynthia Kelly from the Brain Injury Alliance of Minnesota. And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Kelly, and I am the Public Policy Associate with the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance. I'm here to testify on behalf of HF 3635, which is, as you know, a citizen-led bill that seeks safer bus transit for people with disabilities and mobility limitations. This bill adds a driver training requirement regarding safety for people who use walkers on Metro Transit as well as the suburban opt-out providers, especially in inclement weather. The goal of this bill is to enhance existing training for drivers to ensure they have the tools and training needed when the situation arrives. As you heard from Joy, who's here with us today, her personal story of the importance of this bill. I also want to mention that Joy, as well as the public policy director, met in June with Metro Transit operations and accessibility staff to discuss this bill. We also spoke with Metro Council public policy staff, and they are in favor of this bill. I want to thank Representative Dabney for chief authoring this bill and thank committee members and staff for hearing this bill today.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Kelly, and for all the great work that the Brain Injury Alliance does in so many different spheres, but I know we've worked with you a lot in the transportation arena over many years, so thank you for that. I don't know, I have Mr. Shetman on my list. I don't know if he's here as a resource or wants to testify, but I know that Mr. Shetman is on the call, and I would invite him to make comments if needed, or if not, that's fine as well.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'll be very, very brief. It is the council's privilege to support this bill, and similarly as how we did in the Senate earlier this session, we did have an opportunity to meet with Ms. Rindles-Hayden and work with Mr. Nachbar from the Brain Injury Alliance as well, and are here to speak in favor of the bill. In particular, we are supporting the provision that has the council work with the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee, and feel that that is a good idea, and happy to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shetman. I see one member question so far from Representative Mason.
Mr. Chair, and this is to Joy. I have the impression that you ride public transit on a regular basis, and my question is, is what happened an isolated?
Representative Mason, you're muted.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay. It is to our first testifier. My question is, was this, in your opinion, an isolated incident in that? I don't know what to tell you. I just seem to wait.
We can hear you, though. We can hear you.
Okay. My question is, in your opinion or in your experience, was this an isolated incident, or is it typical that you get no help when you're getting on and off the vehicle?
Ms. Rindles Hayden.
Typically, you do not get any assistance getting off the bus. The reason this bill is so important is that it deals with snow removal issues, and we had a good discussion on our bill last August with the three staff from Metro Transit, which included getting the snow removed so that the ramp can be properly put out and this accident can be prevented. It can happen again because snow removal people do not realize the incidents. They did not see me go to the hospital 5 days later in the middle of the night, because it's not an immediate thing that happens. Stroke can happen up to 5 days afterwards. So they don't have any connection with the falling and the stroke necessarily. So the skill is to get the drivers trained in the angle issues of the ramp and the walker, and avoiding this and taking people to the safe spot and giving them another transfer, and to train the snow driver removal people in a timely fashion. And there's no reason with these young people standing around with their tablets and their cell phones why they can't pick up a shovel and help prevent a terrible accident like this happening to seniors in their neighborhood. This is just not Minnesota. We are better than that. We have to get other people involved if the snow driver people refuse to be part of the solution in a timely fashion.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Just a comment. I have signed on to the bill. But in my opinion, the training should be something that should be automatic as part of the normal training of the driver. So the fact that we have to have a law for this, to me, is kind of mind-boggling. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mason. I don't see any other member questions, so... Chairman Dabney, do you have any final thoughts you want to leave us with? And then we'll take a vote on your bill.
Before I do that, Mr. Chair, I noticed that Mr. Shetnin unmuted.
Oh, okay. Mr. Shetnin, did you want to make any final comments?
Great. Well, thank you, Chair Dabney, and thank you, Chair Hornstein. I just wanted to add that this is a normal course of training for our drivers, and our drivers, our new drivers, our seasoned drivers receive training on how to work with passengers who have limited mobility issues. I also just want to make sure that we're talking about the difference here between Metro Transit regular route type services and Metro Mobility services, which have two different ways that we work with our passengers. But this was a very unfortunate incident, as we can all see, and I want to make sure that folks know that the council and Metro Transit take this very seriously, but I also want to make sure that folks understand that this, our drivers do receive regular training related to this. As Representative Mason just pointed out, I wanted to make sure that folks understand that this is part of our regular training. And again, in order to make sure that this bill moves forward, we're supporting the aspect of the bill that relates to making sure that we have these conversations with the Transportation Accessibility and Advisory Committee. And so thank you for that, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to jump in there, Representative Dabney.
Thanks for your comments, Mr. Shetnin. Okay, final words, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, let me thank you for providing this hearing opportunity today. I hope that members noted that Ms. Rindles Hayden indicated that her accident happened in January of 2017, over 5 years ago. So I really want to credit her with the tenacity that she's shown throughout the years to try to make sure that transit ridership is safer for everyone, and appreciate that her consistency and her tenacity. I want to thank the Brain Injury Association, Ms. Clay and Mr. Nakbar, for their engagement and advocacy and support, both for Ms. Rindles Hayden and myself, and their engagement with Metro Transit. And thank you, Mr. Shettinen, for Metro Transit's engagement and support of the bill. With that, members, I would ask for your support and a yes vote on today's motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
And thank you, Chair Dabney, for bringing this bill to us, an important bill. So, members, we will. This is going to the General Register. The motion is to re-refer it to the General Register. And to that motion, Mr. Dodge, please take the roll of members.
Chair Hornstein?
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Vice Chair Cagle?
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, aye.
Petersburg, aye. Representative Barr?
Aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Elkins?
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hausman?
Aye.
Hausman, aye. Representative Heinrich?
Heinrich, aye.
Heinrich, aye. Representative Kosnick?
Aye.
Kosnick, aye. Representative Mason?
Mason, aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Murphy?
Murphy, aye.
Murphy, aye. Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Olson?
Olson, aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Richardson?
Richardson, aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Torkelson?
Torkelson, aye.
Torkelson, aye. Representative West?
West, aye.
West, aye. There are 17 ayes and 0 nays.
Thank you very much. The bill is on its way to General Register. Thank you so much, Representative Dabney, and appreciate your work on this and on the work of all the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. And our next bill on the agenda is House File 2941. And I will move that House File 2941 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus transportation bill. Members, this relates to the Mercy program. We had some funding for this last year, and Representative Torkelson's come forward with a bill this year as well. It is an important program related to our freight rail system in the state. And Representative Torkelson, thank you for bringing the bill forward. And please tell us about it. And I know we have a couple of testifiers as well. So welcome, Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you very much for hearing this bill in the Transportation Committee today. I do have a theme song, but I won't play it, Mr. Chair, out of respect for your leadership. The Mercy Program, the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, is an important program administered by the Minnesota Department of Transportation that assists our short line rails, railroads, freight railroads, all across Minnesota. I have a testifier that will fill us in on many of the details, so I would prefer to hear from her rather than from myself. Tina Ryberg, VP for Operations and Administration at Twin Cities and Western Railroad, is with us today.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Thank you, Ms. Ryberg. And I believe Ms. Erickson also has a slide presentation that you'll be narrating. Is that correct? Excellent. Looks like everything is working well.
Not too bad.
Ms. Ryberg, welcome to the committee, and Representative Murphy, if you could mute, thank you. Ms. Ryberg, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Representative Torkelson and Chair Hornstein, thank you for the opportunity today to testify on an issue that's very important to Minnesota's small railroads. My name is Tina Ryberg. I'm the Assistant Vice President of Administration and Operations for the Twin Cities and Western Railroad. The TCNW operates 229 miles of track running from St. Paul, Minnesota to Millbake, South Dakota. For the past 30 years, we've run through some of the most productive agricultural areas in Western Minnesota, hauling grain, fertilizer, ethanol, lumber, limestone, and just a variety of other farm-related freight. Today, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Regional Rail Association, which includes 18 freight railroads, large and small, that provide freight rail service to Minnesota rail shippers, large and small as well, that connects them to the national and international marketplaces. I'm pleased to speak in support of Representative Torkelson's bill. This will provide $20 million in added funding for the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Program, also known as the MRSI program. MRSI is a grant and a loan program. It's managed by MnDOT. It provides funding for improvements to short line railroads and for rail shippers. Short line railroads are the smaller ones of the operations. They provide that first and the last mile to local, mainly rural, businesses and communities. Representative Torkelson's bill will help offset some of the very expensive costs of replacing our state's aging rail infrastructure. In MnDOT's 2015 state rail plan, the cost of getting the Minnesota Short Line Railroad track standards up to those of the large railroads that they connect to exceeded $250 million. As you can imagine, railroading is a very capital-intense business. Replacing tracks, some of which is over 80 years old, can cost as much as $500,000 per mile. Replacing a bridge can cost as much as $1 million to $5 million or even more, depending on that length of that bridge. And the annual maintenance that we do to ensure safe operations can run from $15,000 to $20,000 per mile. For the small railroads that struggle to meet these costs, the MRSI program can help them make upgrades to the infrastructure, which improves service for the rail shippers. And these improvements in turn often generate new investments by those customers that they serve, and it motivates new investments by new customers. Railroads exist only for one reason, and that is to move stuff. Investing in Minnesota short line railroads directly benefits the producers, the businesses, and the communities that they serve. This keeps our economy strong, like our agricultural and our mining sectors, where we rank first in the nation in the movement of iron ore, and third and fourth, respectively, in the origination of farm and food products. And finally, just let me note that railroads move freight more efficiently with less impact on the environment. The average rail car carries three times more freight than a truck, and a locomotive is roughly three times more fuel efficient with 75% less emissions than trucks. States all around Minnesota have been investing in their railroads for years. And so we just want to thank Chair Hornstein and Representative Torkelson for understanding the importance of doing the same thing here for our state. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Ryberg. And I don't know, Ms. Erickson, did you want to also testify, or you were just kind of facilitating the slides?
Chair Hornstein, I'm here to answer any questions should they come up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Erickson. Okay, members, with that, speaking of questions, do we have any questions of either Ms. Erickson or Ms. Ryberg? Okay, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Torkelson, thank you for bringing this forward. I know that we put dollars into the MRSI Fund quite often. How did you, and I think it's important for us to kind of know, how did you arrive at the $20 million? I think there was a analysis on what the need was, but could you clarify that for us?
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Petersburg, for the question. The information, my most recent information I just received today notes a need of about $150 million across the state of Minnesota on a wide variety of projects. I can certainly share that information if necessary. In the last go around, I think there were approximately five times as many applications as there were. The value of the application was approximately five times the amount of money that was available in the program. So there's a real need, this really helps our short line railroads. I mean, these are basically, in many ways, small businesses operating in a very capital intensive environment, but supplying a valuable service to Minnesota. And I just remind the committee that every ton that we move on the rail is one less ton that gets hauled on our highways, And that means our highways last longer. And because the railroads are more efficient, it's also environmentally friendly because we're producing less CO2 and other pollutants by putting these goods on the railroads. But they got to have the rails to run on. And finally, I'd remind everyone how much cheaper it is than that light rail, which is much more costly per mile than our freight rail.
Okay. Representative Petersburg, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I would say, yeah, I think, you know, lately we have, and thank you, Representative Torkelson, for that. It does seem like with the surplus we have, if we can get a target for transportation that allows us to do this, it would make sense. And since we've had some real issues with supply chain issues, anything that we can do to help improve that into the future, I think that is beneficial. So thank you for that, Representative Torkelson.
Okay, thank you for the question. And Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to just ask a little bit about this, and it might be for staff, I'm not sure. But this is an appropriation. And one of the things I've needed some funding for our community for railroad bridge as well. And I know the challenges it faces and the issues that it creates for safety and, you know, other things that are tied to it. And what I wanted to find out, is there any policy in this part of legislation that can tie collaborating with communities to coexist with trails or do things like that? Because if we're funding railroads to make improvements, it seems it's a great opportunity to partner with other needs in the community to do two projects at once. And so I wanted to find out if this is an area that could be addressed in this bill, or would it require a different bill?
Okay, I think what I heard here, thank you, Chair Bernardi. I think what I heard here was, either for the author, the testifiers, even MnDOT, what are the criteria for support from the Mercy program? I think that's really the gist of the question. It's a good question, too. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson here. That is a good question. I would defer to staff, but it does sound to me like you might be talking about rail grade separation projects. But she's shaking her head.
No.
So this program, as I understand, is aimed at improving the freight rail road itself. But I'd be happy to hear from others.
Is there someone on the call that can just very quickly go over some of the basic criteria for support from this program?
Mr. Chair, with the Minnesota Regional Rail, if MnDOT's on, I would defer to them. But Representative Bernardi, I think in your case, I think you're dealing with a Class 1 railroad in your area, if I'm not mistaken. This program, the Mercy program, is specific to short line railroads, and I'm happy to put up the map again. And it's the criteria for it, generally speaking, is for investment in upgrading the rails, upgrading the basic infrastructure of the short lines. And to my knowledge, there isn't provisions in there for community engagement, but I think we're probably talking about two different issues, unless you do have a short line that runs through your area.
Okay, hang on, folks. I know Mr. Dukic is on. I know he was probably more prepared to address the next agenda item, but if he has any thoughts on just the basic criteria, I believe that Representative Torkelson, I think, summarized it well, but if there's anything else on criteria we should know about, and then I will switch back over to Representative Bernardi, because I know that you were, I think, wanted to clarify your question a little bit for our testifiers. So, Mr. Dukic, anything else we need to know about the criteria? Again, I thought Representative Torkelson and Ms. Erickson summarized that well, but if there's anything that you would like to add?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Again,
John. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Yes, of course, Mr. Chair, members, John Dukic with MnDOT Government Affairs. I don't have anything to add. I think both Representative Torkelson and the other testifier summarized well what the program is meant to do, which is upgrade and update the rail infrastructure. I'm happy to send Representative Bernardi additional information on the program and connect her with appropriate folks at MnDOT if she has other detailed questions about how the program runs. But you know, there isn't a requirement to partner with communities for trail improvements and that type of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Dukic. Representative Bernardi, I think you wanted to add to this conversation.
Yes, I do, and I can't wait till Representative Elkins, if he weighs in on this as well. But I wanted to just clarify that the assumptions that were made about the rail line being class one in my community, that I've been involved in some of these improvements, and in my community, one was a railroad bridge that was replaced. And we did put language in there that was collaborative with the community. And I just really think it's important before these rails are upgraded and changes are made that the community is involved in it. And, you know, the only leverage we have with railroads is being, if, you know, we're going to give state funding, then we need to make sure that we're looking in the public's best interest. And that means collaborating with their communities and knowing what plans they have for their communities, what the issues are in their community. And, in one circumstance that I'm referring to, the plans that were going to take place, it was going to impact waterways and cause issues. And so we addressed those, and they had to collaborate with the community to make sure that it was not left in ill repair for how it would impact people in the community, as well as other areas where the community was just waiting for the dilapidated rail to disintegrate, and they had plans to put trails on rails. And so when you make those improvements, they're going to last a lot longer, and actually they can coexist together. And so making that part of the process when these improvements are made, it's critical that our communities have a voice when we are making these kinds of investments. And they are important investments, and I believe that there's an opportunity to have community benefit in addition to the upgrade for the railroad.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Bernardi. I don't know if anyone wanted to respond. We do have another member with a question. Before I call on Representative Elkins, I am going to hand over the virtual gavel to Vice Chair Cagle, as I need to get ready for another hearing in another committee. So Representative Elkins, and then Representative Cagle, you are in charge as of now. So thank you, members, and Representative Elkins.
Yeah, not so much that question as a comment. I just want to support everything that Representative Bernardi just said, and just observe that we do have a short line rail line in Bloomington, Progressive Rail, and a local railroad buff walked the length of the tracks a few years ago and took pictures indicating that some of the rail that's still in use had stamps on it indicating that it dated all the way back to the original rails that were laid in 1910. And, you know, in Bloomington, where that line crosses Nine Mile Creek, the city has long had concerns that that bridge is in such decrepit shape that the whole thing could collapse and a train go into Nine Mile Creek. So I think that some investment in upgrading these short line railroads is warranted.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. And Representative Cagle, you can take us home here and see if there's any other conversation about this particular bill.
Sounds good. I don't see any additional hands up, so give it just a second. All right. Representative Torkelson, would you like to make a closing statement?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would, and thank you, Representative Bernardi, for your questions. I would be happy to work with you if there's room for improvement in the Mercy program to bring in language that recognizes the needs of the surrounding community. But this may be one of those situations where myself as a rural representative just doesn't understand the impact on of a short line in a more urban setting, and we'd be happy to work with you on that. But as far as rails to trails, I'm kind of on the opposite side. I want to keep the rails because we've in my mind turned too many railroads into trails. So we need to keep our railroad network in good functioning order. Where we can partner, that would be great. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill, and I look forward to working on it as we move through the process.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. With that, we will lay over House File 2941 for possible inclusion in a transportation omnibus bill. Next up on our agenda is a presentation from MnDOT on the trunk highway bonding And so I will turn it over to, not even going to attempt, Josh. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And you're muted.
Good afternoon, everyone. Bear with me as I bring up the presentation. Just a moment. Can I get quick confirmation? Perfect. Should I proceed? Thank you.
Well,
good afternoon, members. My name is Josh Knatterd-Hubinger. I'm serving as the interim CFO at MnDOT. I'm going to give a quick overview of kind of the current state of trunk highway bonding, just to give some context for the discussions this session on a larger capital bill, and so just giving a kind of level setting where we're currently set. So I'm going to go through some slides fairly quickly. I'll try to hit the very relevant notes as we go here. A lot of this will be familiar to this committee, but I'll just hit the topic points as I go here. So largely in the transportation world, we have dedicated funding. For the most part, that flows through the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. The quick refresher, that's made up of a variety of dedicated transportation taxes, gas taxes and registration taxes being the largest. 60% of the sales tax on motor vehicles, and then a variety of other dedicated state sales taxes that started going into this fund in 2018. All told, this makes up around $2.5 billion right now on an annual basis. And then as prescribed in the Constitution, you can see the flow of how those funds work their way through. Trunk Highway Fund in the bottom left corner receives just under 60% of this revenue. And because of all the needs on the system, trunk highway bonding in particular has become a very helpful tool in the toolbox over the last decade especially. So quick clarification, trunk highway bonds fall under the same requirements as all other general obligation bonds. So all trunk highway bonds are general obligation bonds. Not all general obligation bonds are trunk highway bonds. And the very big distinction for trunk highway bonds specifically, the debt on those bonds is repaid from that trunk highway fund. So otherwise, lots of the same bonding requirements apply. We still have to comply with the MMB debt policies. Trunk highway bonds impact those policies, the debt capacity guidelines. But the big distinction, trunk highway bonds have to be for a trunk highway purpose, and the debt is repaid from the trunk highway fund. And I'll go through some more detail in a moment, but this, as I mentioned, has become quite a significant source of financing over the last decade plus, starting with Chapter 152 back in 2008, almost $4.5 billion since that time. And of that $4.5 billion, just to connect the dots to the testimony from a week ago, more than a quarter of that funding over the last 10 years plus has been for the Corridors of Commerce program. So a quick history on trunk highway bonding, again, really kicked off with the revenue increases back in 2008 as part of the Chapter 152 package, $1.8 billion with a significant amount of that dedicated to bridges. Since that time, there's been trunk highway bonding authorized many years through the legislature. Over the last couple years, working backwards in our most recent biennial budget bill in June of 2021, an additional $413 million of trunk highway bonds were authorized for a couple different purposes. There's some funding for the kind of normal state road construction program, $113 million for some specific projects, and then an additional $200 million for corridors of commerce. The previous authorization before that was in that October 2020 bonding bill, about $300 million, again for a couple different purposes, some specific larger rail grade crossing projects, again $84 million for that more bread and butter state road construction program, $58 million for facilities, and then some money for project development and flood mitigation. So the impact on state road construction specifically over the last, since 2012, you can see the blue bars are the normal cash appropriations in that trunk highway fund, largely paid for from a combination of federal funds and the state sales taxes, the gas tax, registration taxes, et cetera. But then that orange bar on top is the portion in addition from trunk highway bonding. And so you can see it varies year to year based on how we use it, but it's averaged about 20% of the overall program over the last 10 years. So it's a sizable portion of how we pay for trunk highway projects at this point. Just a kind of logistics process clarification. So once bonds are authorized in law, the way those bonds are translated to cash, they are sold one or two times per year. There's some kind of criteria behind the scenes that goes into how often bond sales occur. That whole process is managed by MMB. They oversee all debt for the state. Typically, the bond sales are sometime in the fall. The most recent bond sale was last September 2021. We sold $311 million of trunk highway bonds at about 1.5% true interest cost. So very low interest rates over the last couple of years. Bonding has been a very cheap financing tool. So timing-wise, all the authorizations over the last decade have benefited quite significantly from very low interest rates. So again, because of that timing process, you can see, going back to 2008, that first column is the total amount of trunk highway bonds that have been authorized by the legislature. So over $4 billion. But that money is then issued through bond sales. And so where we're at as of that last September bond sale, we still have about $1.4 billion of that $4.3 billion remaining to be sold. And that will occur over the next couple years. So about a third of the money is still waiting to be sold via those bond sales. And I will note another wrinkle that has come up, especially more consistently lately. You'll see the footnote for the 2017, 18, and 2021 authorizations. Those bonds are authorized over multiple years. And so we don't technically have access to significant chunks of that money until we get to subsequent fiscal years. So as an easy example, the most recent bond sale or bond authorization in our 2022-2023 biennial budget that passed last June, in total authorized $413 million in bonds. But $200 million of that for the Corridors of Commerce program won't be available until fiscal years 24 for $100 million and fiscal year 25 for another $100 million. So again, it takes some time from authorization to the point where this money actually goes out the door. So on the flip side, as I mentioned, the Trunk Highway Fund is responsible for repaying this debt. This is just our current February 2022 forecast of those debt transfers that occur once every year. You can see in 2021, we paid $178 million to repay trunk highway debt. That's projected to increase over the next couple of years as we sell those authorized but unissued bonds, peaking at $304 million out in fiscal year 2025. Just another way of looking at the debt as a portion of the total spending in the Trunk Highway Fund, you can see here the general trend has been for an increase over the last decade and increasing a little bit more over those next couple years, again, as we utilize that additional bonding authorization we already have. So I mentioned briefly the debt capacity guidelines from MMB. So that's statewide guidelines that apply to all debt, general obligation bonds, and general obligation trunk highway bonds. We, MnDOT as an agency, also have an internal debt service policy for specifically for the Trunk Highway Fund. So our policy is that debt repayment can't exceed 20% of our state revenues in any given year. The red bar on the chart is that 20%. The blue bar is the current forecast of that percentage as of the February forecast. So you can see it's working its way up to a peak of 18.2% in fiscal year 2025. And so when you do the math, that means we currently have a capacity of a little over $305 million, meaning we could sell another $305 million or authorize another $305 million of trunk highway bonds and still comply with that 20% limit. One other nuance for debt in the Trunk Highway Fund, part of the Chapter 152 law that passed in 2008 included a portion of the gas tax increase dedicated to the debt that was also authorized. So Chapter 152 authorized $1.8 billion in bonds, part of the current gas tax of 28.5 cents. 3.5 cents of that is a debt service surcharge specifically intended to repay that Chapter 152 debt. A small quirk there is only the trunk highway portion of that 3.5 cents applies to this policy. Otherwise, for the local county stated highway and municipal stated street, it's just a regular gas tax, no different than the other 25 cents. And current forecast out in 2039, this is per the statute that prescribes this debt service surcharge. That surcharge is actually a little short of repaying that debt. There's about a $300 million gap right now between the projected debt service costs of Chapter 152 and the revenue being derived from that debt service surcharge portion of the gas tax. And in effect, that just means the other gas tax and the other transportation revenues are covering that gap. And then quick summary of what's in the governor's capital budget and focusing on the trunk highway bond requests. So this is just a summary of all the requests in the governor's capital budget. You can see three items that are trunk highway bonds or trunk highway cash. So of that total, about $400 million in requests, a little over $150 million of the requests are in some way trunk highway projects. And the trunk highway bond portion of those projects is $149 million. So reminder again, our policy says we can afford an additional $305 million in bonds. If the governor's bill passed as it's currently constructed, that would leave another about $150 million of capacity for trunk highway bonds. And then very briefly, just covering those trunk highway requests specifically, there's a request for $80 million of trunk highway bonds for high priority bridges. Also, this could be a source for leveraging federal funds, especially from the new IIJA bill that's still working its way through the final stages of federal approval. And then the other sizable request is a $71-plus million request for facilities. A very sizable portion of that, about $66 million, is for one large kind of facility upgrade in Virginia. That would be both for the headquarters there, but also largely for a vastly improved maintenance facility. A reminder for MnDOT specifically, even over the last 2 years with all the impacts of COVID and many of our central office employees and others working from home, overall as an agency, 75% of our employees have been working from the office or truck station. And so making sure we have facilities in tip-top shape to get through the snow and ice season and being able to maintain our roads throughout the year is very, very important. And trunk highway bonds is one tool we continually use to support those facilities. And then there's a $5 million request. This is actually a cash request from the Trunk Highway Fund directly. Some of the challenges for bonding is making sure that requests are bondable. And so in some cases, the request maybe starts as a bonding request, and then working with MMB, we determine maybe there's some portion that doesn't directly apply to those strict bond eligibility requirements. And so in this case, this became a cash request from the Trunk Highway Fund. And this is for enhanced truck parking at two key rest areas in the St. Cloud region. And that's all I had. I stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ned and Rudy Binger. And it looks like we have a couple questions already. First up is Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the presentation, Mr. Natterud. The trunk highway bonds, I should know this, but I've forgotten. Do they cancel if they aren't issued within a certain period of time, some of the general obligation bonds?
Mr. Nenrud Hubinger.
KH works just fine as well for time purposes. So, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, just like most things, the same rules apply to trunk highway bonds. So they have to be encumbered within that four-year window of when they're authorized. So if they're the bonds that were authorized last June would have to be encumbered by December 31st of 2025. Otherwise, they'd be on that cancellation report for that year. The one quirk is that clock doesn't start until the year they're authorized. So that $200 million for quarters of commerce that starts in 24 and 25, they get 4 years from that year. So.
Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we have any that are near cancellation or that have been recently canceled?
Mr. KH.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Torkelson. Yes, as part of the process, there is a small amount of remaining Chapter 152 bonds, as an example. Those were also spread out over many years, and so the last authorization that was in 2016, there is a portion of that that's currently on the cancellation report. I believe it's right around $2 million.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one final question. So can we reauthorize those if we choose to?
Mr. KH?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have worked with fiscal staff, so that has been identified as a request working its way through the process. So that is the end goal, yes.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To your slide on capital investment bonding, you had both GEO and Trunk Highway. I didn't see intercity passenger rail on there at all. Did I miss something?
Mr. Cage?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hausman, there is $16 million specifically for rail corridor improvements, but the details of that request, that would basically align with the corridor from here to Duluth for Northern Lights.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman?
Thank you.
Next up, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question in regards to the surcharge for the 2008 bonds. So I know that most of our bonds are issued for about 20 years, and I believe that there is some process for that surcharge to blink off when those are getting paid. Can you tell us and remind us how that works and when that will start blinking off?
Mr. Cage.
Madam Chair, Representative Petersburg, great question. So the statute like you said, it's that surcharge is 3.5 cents. Every year we have to certify to Department of Revenue whether it should be 3.5 cents or less. That's the cap. Based on that shortfall, the projection is for it to remain at that 3.5 cents through the life of repaying the Chapter 152 bonds, and then until that debt is completely repaid. So right now we're looking at somewhere in the mid-2040s when that surcharge would blink off.
Representative Petersburg?
Okay, thank you. So how long were some of these projects? I mean, when did the last authorized project actually start then? Are we talking about they're still in play now?
Mr. Cage.
Madam Chair, Representative Petersburg. So again, because of that kind of unique timing quirk, so Chapter 152 bonds were authorized originally over 10 years, subsequently reduced down to 8. So the last authorization was in 2016. We have 4 years from then to get the projects encumbered, but the clock on the debt repayment doesn't start until you sell the bonds, which can take a couple additional years on top of that. So we actually sold some additional Chapter 152 bonds in that last September sale last year. So in the early 2040s is when we'll be completely done repaying Chapter 152 bonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any additional questions? I'm not seeing any additional questions. I guess I do have one. So as we add more debt, does that push out the date for that 3.5 cents? Mr. Cage?
Madam Chair, so the statute is currently specifically only to Chapter 152. Okay. So any bonds since then are being paid for from all the other trunk highway sources doesn't impact that surcharge at all.
Thank you. Any additional questions? We have some time, so.
Madam Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
I was slow finding my finger button, so I'll just dive in. One of the things that's being talked about this year is authorizing allocation of more sales tax dollars on auto parts and repairs from the general fund. And if that were to happen, that would add additional capacity to trunk highway bond authorizations if we should choose to use it. Is that correct, Mr. KH?
Mr. KH.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's correct. So anything that's a state-sourced revenue that flows through the trunk highway fund counts as part of that policy. So new gas tax, new sales taxes, the interest earnings in the fund, that all counts. So yes, that would definitely increase capacity.
Representative Torkelson?
And Madam Chair, thank you for that answer, Mr. Cage. There's also proposals out there that would have a gas tax holiday. Would that have a reverse impact on that trunk highway bond capacity?
Mr. KH.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, yes, absent any kind of backfill from another source, less revenue means less bonding capacity. Yes.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson?
That's it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, members, last call for questions. Seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Natarud Hubinger. Did I get it right?
That's very good. thank you very much.
All right, members, and just a reminder, our next meeting is Tuesday, March 15th at 1 o'clock. With no further business before us, I adjourn this meeting.